And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycle candy. And we're going to get right into our commentary for today. This commentary is from the Environmental News Network, written by Jean-Michel Cousteau, and I believe he is related to the late Jacques Cousteau. And it's entitled, Superfish Are No Super Fix for Hunger, H-U-N-G-E-R there. Behold the superfish, a salmon that grows six times as fast and twice as large as normal farmed Atlantic salmon, but only consumes three-quarters as much feed before it is brought to market. Sound like science fiction? It's not. Some 100,000 of these fish already exist, produced by a Canadian company, and are awaiting the official sanction of the federal food agencies in the United States, the world's main market for farmed fish. They and others like them might be in stores as early as 2002. This creature is the latest in a series of inventions being offered as food to a world many believe may be teetering on the brink of starvation. The problem is that, like many genetically altered and engineered life forms, this salmon may end up destroying more lives than it saves. How do you build a better salmon? In this case, part of the DNA of a winter flounder is matched to the salmon's growth hormone to produce a mixed or transgenic species. Over the past decade, researchers have also found a way to alter tilapia and other fish so that they will produce human growth hormone, or HGH. The resulting superfish grow faster and larger on less feed. It's an entrepreneur's dream come true, yet despite the optimism of inventors and the governmental and private that support them, there are enormous environmental risks involved in developing transgenic species. In a major study of the effects of releasing transgenic species into the wild, William Muir and Richard Howard of Purdue University discovered that more than 30% of Japanese micata born with the human genetic or growth hormone gene did not live to sexual maturity. In the market, this is not important. Fish can be sold and eaten before they are sexually mature. But in nature, surviving to sexual maturity is everything. The superfish may dominate the mating game, but if they are least likely to produce viable offspring, the population will eventually decline. How large will these declines be? Mathematically, at least, there is no limit. By using computer models, the Purdue scientists calculated that if 60 transgenics were released into a population of 60,000 wild fish, it would take only 40 generations for the species to become extinct. With fewer modified fish, the result was the same. It just took longer to get there. Advocates of genetic engineering maintain that these fish can be rendered sterile and isolated from wild populations. Both contentions are dubious. Complete sterilization of all fish is simply not a reality, nor is it likely to be. No company has stepped forward to guarantee 100% perfection in sterility, and nothing short of perfection is acceptable, for it only takes one well-endowed superfish in a population of wild salmon to start the process of a decline. The same goes for total isolation, another pipe dream. The best containment systems are expensive enough to discourage even the most enthusiastic investor. That leaves open water containment in netted farms as the currently practiced in countries such as Norway, Ireland, Canada, New Zealand, and other places. The biotechnology industry across the board has a notoriously poor record when it comes to containing its little Frankensteins, be they pollens, seeds, or fish. The so-called net cage aquaculture fits this pattern. In British Columbia, Canada, environmental groups have filed lawsuits to stop the practice. They charge that the cages spread disease to wild fish, dump antibiotics and other drugs into wild habitats, and allow more aggressive farmed fish to escape and outcompete wild species. Despite the likely negative impact, the race is on to build bigger, better fish. The same company that is engineering char, flounder, tilapia, and trout with the same boosted characteristics. According to Greenpeace, similar research is underway in many countries, including China, Taiwan, and New Zealand. Commercial stocking has already begun in Canada, Chile, Cuba, and Scotland. Supposedly, the rush to engineer new strains of foods, fish included, is a response to world hunger. In this version of events, biotechnology is a second green revolution. But what is the point of having more food if poverty prevents vast segments of the human family from sharing in the bounty? Some 786 million people are officially malnourished. But the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has recently hinted that there is in fact no shortage of food globally, merely a shortage of equity, accountability, and ethics. In many wealthy countries, one can now purchase any food at any time of the year, while rural villagers in developing countries are starving. This is no coincidence. According to the FAO, hunger in the developing world is caused in large part by a massive shift from subsistence farming to production for export, a shift encouraged by international lending institutions like the World Bank and governments. Autarkic agriculture, with its high costs for engineered seeds, petrochemical fertilizers, and pesticides, accelerates this trend toward exports. Small-scale subsistence farmers cannot afford to farm and abandoned the fields to wealthy corporate agribusiness concerns. In India, the system has reached its logical, if absurd, conclusion. Rice and wheat are rotting in bulging state storehouses, while a third of the population is undernourished, too poor to buy those food staples. In this market, when nearly a billion people can't afford the basics, why is there such a rush to engineer new fish? Not to ease the world hunger, no, simply because there is money to be made in selling to wealthy consumers in industrial nations. And for this short-term gain, bioengineers the world over are willing to risk damaging Earth's life system at the most fundamental genetic level. If we were to apply our ingenuity to designing and nurturing a more equitable social order, stabilizing both our numbers and material appetites, I believe we could find that we still have enough to get by without tampering with the very codes of life. Our commentary this evening from Jean-Michel Cousteau, writer for the Environmental News Network, and was entitled Superfish Are No Superfix for Hunger. Moving back to the United States Congress, stop the anti-roadless area riders. Call Congress, the number is 202-224-3121, and ask your representative to vote against an Interior Department appropriations bill that includes either of the following anti-roadless protection riders. First is the White Mountain National Forest exemption, which exempts the White Mountain National Forest from the final roadless policy. New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg's amendment, which exempts the New Hampshire from the roadless area protection policy, has remained in the Interior Appropriations Bill. 250,000 roadless areas are at stake, including the largest roadless area in the East, the 75,000-acre Pemigewasset roadless area. Senator Gregg does not represent the will of residents of New Hampshire or the interests of their forests. A total of four hearings regarding the roadless forest protection policy were held in New Hampshire, and these meetings were publicly open to all members of the public. Those who attended were overwhelmingly in favor of protecting roadless areas, as are nearly three-quarters of the citizens of New Hampshire, according to a recent poll conducted by Lake Snell Perry & Associates. The second amendment is the Domenici Fire Amendment, which requires the Forest Service to identify conflicts between proposed regulations, including roadless area protection, and the Cohesive Fire Strategy. The Cohesive Fire Strategy amendment offered by Senator Domenici requires the Forest Service to identify any differences between the fire strategy and the proposed roadless area protection regulations. If enacted, the delay caused by the consistency review could derail and ultimately kill the roadless area protection policy. Once again, call your congressperson, your senator or congressperson, at the U.S. Capitol switchboard, the number again, 202-224-3121, and ask for your representative. The Fund for Animals, the Animal Protection Institute, and the Pennsylvania Legislative Animal Network are urging Pennsylvania residents to contact their state legislators in support of a bill that would halt the newly approved trapping and hunting season on bobcats. Unless legislatures intervene, the new season will begin on October 14th. Non-Pennsylvania residents are urged to write as well. If you live in Pennsylvania, write to your state representatives. If you need to know who that is, go to www.house.state.pa.us. Once again, that's house.state.pa.us, and you can figure out who your representative is there. If you don't live in Pennsylvania, please write to the Pennsylvania governor, Governor Ridge, and here's a webpage that will help you do that, www.pa.us/pa_exec/governor/govmail state.html. Once again, that's www.state.pa.us/. I guess it makes a difference. Capital PA underscore capital EXEC underscore capital G in governor / govmail, all lowercase, at HTML. .html. Okay. And here we have our Buffalo Action Alert. Public support is needed for a 60-day extension of the public review and comment period on the final environmental impact statement for bison management in the Yellowstone and Montana areas. Ecology Center Incorporated in Cold Mountain Cold Rivers of Missoula, Montana, announced that they are calling for an extension of the public review and comment period on the final environmental impact statement for bison management in Yellowstone and Montana. The groups requested the Bison Management Plan EIS team extend the public comment period by 60 days. Your public comments are currently due next Tuesday, October 2nd. An extension of the comment period is warranted for several reasons. The FEIS is a complex document totaling 3 volumes and covering 2,100 pages. Extensive new information is presented in the final EIS that requires further review. New technical information is presented in the EIS that requires further analysis, and many of the reports and documents cited in the final environmental impact statement are not readily available to the public. Additional time is necessary to access information to review new documentation and scientific research presented in the final environmental impact statement. This information is relevant to understanding environmental impacts and the agency's decisions on long-term bison management and preparing final comments on the government's modified preferred alternative. What can you do? Right. Bison Management Plan, EIM, Yellowstone National Park, Attention Sarah Bransom, YCR, P.O. Box 168, Yosemite National Park, Wyoming, 82190. I'll give you that address again. I know it's a long one, but see if you can keep up here. Bison Management Plan, EIS Team, Yellowstone National Park, Attention Sarah Bransom, YCR, P.O. Box 168, Yellowstone National Park, Wyoming, 82190. And if you didn't get that address, here's a phone number. Maybe you can call Sarah and have her give you that address over the phone. The number 307-344-2159. That's 307-344-2159. And you can also go to nps.gov/planning to view an executive summary of the final environmental impact statement. Here's news from Greenpeace. IKEA, the retailer, has gone ancient forest free. In a joint press conference with Greenpeace, international furniture retailer IKEA made a public commitment to the environment by announcing that it will end all purchases of furniture made with wood from ancient forests. Quote, IKEA's long-term goal is to ensure that all the wood in its products comes from well-managed forests, said Suzanne Bergstrand, IKEA's international environment manager. The first step is to see that no solid wood is coming from ancient forests or forests with high conservation values. IKEA is the world's largest furniture retailer with an $8 billion revenue annually. And the company has contracts with over 2,000 manufacturers in 65 countries that supply its furniture. And we want to thank Greenpeace from their Spring 2000 magazine for that news item. And the logging industry was exempted from recent Environmental Protection Agency proposed rules, which would have required non-point source polluting industries to reduce water pollution. The proposed rule, released in August of 1999, revises the existing EPA regulations for administering the total maximum daily load provisions of the Clean Water Act. The proposed rule requires states to set limits on how much pollution would be allowed for non-point sources such as farming, logging, and parking lots that send polluted runoff into streams. The proposed rule's language has very weak on agriculture and forestry non-point sources. In fact, forestry operations would have been exempt for 5 years from the publication of the final rule, which, according to EPA, would allow for the designation and adoption of best management practices programs. This exemption is in clear violation of the Clear Water Act's intent. The EPA should be held accountable to the American public, not the timber industry, for enforcing regulations to protect our nation's water. Senator Blanche Lincoln, a Democrat from Arkansas, Speaking on behalf of the logging and forest industry, sponsored legislation to exempt the forestry industry from the rule. The EPA appears to have caved into pressure from Senator Lincoln and the timber industry. For more information, contact Daniel Hall at American Lands Forest and Biodiversity Program. His phone number, 503-978-0511. That's 503-978-0511. Or wafcbp@teleport.com. That's wafcbp@teleport.com. And according to calculations by Rio Algum's Nicolet Minerals Company and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, NMC's proposed mine near Crandon, Wisconsin, is likely to violate Wisconsin's groundwater standards that allow local pollution of groundwater only up to 1,200 feet away from the mine. In a June 14th joint press release, the Menominee Treaty Rights and Mining Impacts Office, the Wisconsin Stewardship Network, Wolf Watershed Education Project, and the Mining Impact Coalition of Wisconsin announced their discovery that NMC's data indicates that the mine would be the source of groundwater contamination for the next 100 to 200,000 years. The groups criticized the solution by NMC and its consultant in the, quote, reflooded mine management plan. That plan describes a series of wells that would pump the contaminated groundwater away from the mine site to a treatment facility for as long as the mine is a source of contamination. But 100 to 200,000 years? I don't think so. Due to the likelihood of long-term pollution, the groups are asking the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin not to permit that mine. Sounds like a good idea to me. And Colorado residents upset with the effects of pollution from gold mining in the state have formed the Alliance for Responsible Mining, or ARM. This grassroots nonprofit alliance is working on an initiative petition to amend the state's constitution by placing a ban on new open-pit cyanide mines in the state of Colorado. The amendment would also stop the expansion of the existing Cripple Creek and Victor Gold Mining Company. To get the petition for the November ballot, the group needed to have 62,000 signatures before August 7th. I hope they got them. The Colorado Mining Association is opposing the initiative. How unusual. And has already taken it to court. How prudent. Hope they don't succeed in that one. They were successful in getting some minor changes in the wording of the initiative, but the Colorado Supreme Court rejected their attempts to have the word cyanide removed. CAM argued the word was misleading because the public would associate it with poisoning and capital punishment. Well, I certainly hope so. Many Colorado residents still recall when pollution from the Summitville gold mine killed all aquatic life along 17 miles of the Alamosa River in 1990. They continue to see the effects of the mine each spring when snowmelts laden with heavy metals overwhelm the treatment facility. A comment by Ignacio Rodriguez of the Alliance for Responsible Mining expresses the sentiment of many Colorado residents. They got the gold and we got the shaft. If you want more information, visit their webpage, www.responsiblemining.org. That's www.responsiblemining.org, or call ARM at 719-274-0322. That's 719-274-0322, and Uncle Dennis would vote for that initiative if he lived in Colorado. Let's hope all you Colorado residents do, too. Low, slow, and dangerous. A study of 83 accidents with helicopters used in U.S.-based logging operations revealed the vast majority, 73, took place during logging-related maneuvering and not other phases of flight. Of the accidents, which occurred between 1983 and 1999, 46 resulted from mechanical failure, and 27 were attributed to human error, according to a report from the Alexandria, Virginia-based Flight Safety Foundation. Engine failure played a role in 22 crashes. One modified military surplus helicopter certified by the FAA had accumulated more than 13,000 lift cycles in 380 helilogging flight hours. Helilogging operations involve extended periods of low and slow maneuvering close to rugged terrain with limited choices for emergency landing sites. In the accidents surveyed, 23 were fatal and a total of 29 crew members were killed. Two-thirds of the accidents occurred in Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. And in a couple of lawsuits were filed in California against Timber Harvest Plans 1-96-413-HUM and 197.307 HUM, while at the same time citizens took to the woods to prevent the fallers from cutting the trees, while others blocked Maxam's gates. The campaign ended when Epic and the Sierra Club obtained a federal injunction from the logging. Despite these actions, some 30 acres of ancient Douglas fir forest was leveled and laid on the forest floor when the court stepped in. In January 1999, the Humboldt County Superior Court ruled that CDF had abused its discretion in approving the plans without a credible assessment of the likely environmental consequences of the proposed harvest. It was a triumph for the community and the wildlife agencies. Yet, despite the rulings of the court earlier this year, Pacific Lumber filed THP 1-00-218, which called for skidding and yarding of the same downed logs as well as clear-cutting a half acre of green trees. The public pointed out to CDF that there had never been a legal cumulative impact assessment on taking the trees down, but CDF disregarded these concerns. CDF ruled there was no old-growth forest to harvest since the trees had already been cut in 1998. Therefore, no environmental analysis was necessary, and they approved the controversial plan. In addition, THP 1-00-218 includes a half-acre clear-cut of live trees. That area is the exact area local citizens protected in 1998 and therefore remained standing. This is clearly a spite cut from Maxam directed at Matole residents. So here we have a 30-acre clear-cut of ancient forest with no credible impact analysis, and CDF says it's legal? This sends the wrong message to the timber companies, and if they cut down a forest before the public has the opportunity to challenge it in court, the companies reap the awards, even when the courts determine the plan was illegal, stated Matole resident Michael Evanson. If you'd like more information, contact North Coast Timber Monitors. Their number is 707-441-3828, 707-441-3828, or matoledefense@yahoo.com. That's matoledefense@yahoo.com, or go to their website, www.asis.com/tildecoho. Sounds like a good thing to do. I'm going on up there right now. Folks can check that one out. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news in this edition of Earth First Radio. To get your news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, or at least for the next few weeks. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC, download the player, and listen in. There are lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime you want. You can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. The software you need to play the MP3 files is free on that website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Stefan, our intern, and Eon, our field reporter. If you'd like to become a part of the Earth First Radio team, please send email to cruzief@cruzio.com. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. Now we're going to listen to some music from Casey Neal. This one is, of course, his famous Riff Raff.
Travelers who ramble from camp to camp, boat archers and swag. living for.